Hello, it's Robert Bathurst here. I was one of the first guests on My Time Capsule, and Mike has asked me to tell you that you can now listen to the podcast ad-free by subscribing to Acast Plus. Details of how to join are in the description of each episode. Mike says it's very reasonably priced. In fact, Mike says it's a bargain. And who am I to disagree, locked here in his cellar? Anyway, for a small subscription, Acast Plus, My Time Capsule, ad-free. Free. Unlike me.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello, and welcome to My Time Capsule. I'm Mike Fenton-Stevens, and this is the podcast where I ask my guests to tell me the five things from their life that they would choose to preserve in a time capsule. They pick four things that they cherish, but they also pick one thing that they rather dislike about themselves or their life, and we bury that as well. And that's all there is to it. My guest doing that in this episode has been a performer on stage and screen since 1958. Yep, the year I was born. And goes by the unforgettable stage name of Freddie Parrotface Davies. If you don't know him or why he's called that, then you're probably a lot younger than me. But don't worry, all will be explained during our conversation. Freddie has been a comedian for his whole career, starting at Butlin's and then, after success on the TV talent competition Opportunity Knocks, hosted by Huey Green, he appeared on many television shows through the 60s, 70s and 80s. He even had his own comic strip in the children's comic Buster. He started acting quite late in his career, but has been in Heartbeat, Casualty, Last of the Summer Wine, Harbour Lights, Born and Bred, My Family and lots more. He's even worked at the Royal Shakespeare Company. He was in the films Funny Bones, Le Passionné, and a little-known film called Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban. He has his own one-man show, also called Funny Bones, like the film. So here is Freddie Davies and the things he wants to put in a time capsule, and lots of other things, including, I have to say, one of the most amazing Paul McCartney stories I've ever heard. Have fun.
Hello, darling. How are you?
I'm fantastic.
Wonderful.
How brilliant to meet you.
And you too, dear heart. And you too.
You've been part of my life for, well, most of my life, Freddie.
And most of mine as well.
Ever since I was a little boy, I remember seeing you on my television screen.
Thank you. you will have been quite young when I did my first TV, which was Opportunity Knocks. Mm. That was in 1964. And it was the third edition of the first ever series. And it had been rushed on the air because Huey Green was supposed to be doing seven programs for, I think it was ABC television in those days. And they did a pilot, and don't ask, but it didn't work. But they still had him for seven programs. Yeah. So he said, why don't you do this program I used to do on radio called Opportunity Knocks? And they put it, they rushed it out. And they were screaming out for people to go on it. It was right in the middle of the summer, so it wasn't easy to find. And I'd just walked out of a summer season in Dunoon. Well, I'd stuck it for two. I should have been there for 8 weeks. I stuck it for two. The show was called Fun with Freddie. And it consisted of me and a pianist called Tom. And it was in the open air on the front in Dunoon. People didn't pay to come in. They sat in these wet seats because it usually rained in Scotland. And if I got three pregnant women and a dead dog. I was lucky. And I was supposed to do an hour in the morning, an hour in the afternoon, fun with Freddie. It certainly wasn't. So I stuck it for 2 weeks and I had to go back to Manchester to do a radio show.
So really you were quite well established by the time you did Opportunity Knocks then?
No, not at all. No. I'd left Butlins a year before and I'd done two radio shows. And this was this was my second one.
Right.
So I did the radio show, went home to Blackpool. So I was without work. But then Opportunity Knocks came up and the producer, a man called Peter Dulé, wouldn't audition me cold. So he said, look, can I see you work somewhere? I said, okay, I'm doing a little gig on Friday at the Candlelight Club in Oldham. He said, what time are you on? I said, what time can you get here? So he said, I'll be there 10 o'clock. And it really was exactly like this. He came in the dressing room. He said, I love the gag you did with the hat on. He said, I'm going to put you on tomorrow. I said, tomorrow. He said, tomorrow.
So did he basically so say to you, well, what I want is you with the hat,
yep,
do the lisp and tell that joke?
Yes. I did it in my act, purely as a gag in the act. I said, I have a friend who went into a pet shop. He looked at the guy behind the counter and I stuck the hat on and said, Athlete, come here, puppy. And I combined, the character with the hat on with an old budgie joke. And it gave the gag an extra oomph.
Mm.
And that's really how it started. And it only started because a woman in a club in Manchester shouted out, tell us a joke about a budgie. It was better than get off.
And so you were stuck. That was it. You were Freddie Parrotface Davies.
Well, yes, but the name Parrotface sort of came along by error. I mean, I called the guy in the shop Parrotface, right? Come here, Parrotface. I'm just about stick up there. And I thought that if you put Parrotface underneath my name on posters and leaflets, people would say, oh, it's the guy with the hat. So I said, put Parrotface underneath, and it's like bill matter. I mean, you know, in the old variety days, you had to have bill matter, you know.
Mm.
My grandfather's was a portion of shredded wit.
Was your grandfather a performer?
My grandfather was a music hall comedian, and that's why I wanted to do stand-up. I mean, in his day, and when I first started, it wasn't called stand-up. You were called front cloth comics because you stood in front of a cloth and you told jokes. And that's what you were, a front cloth comic. And the reason you did that was because they were changing the scene behind you.
Yeah.
And I virtually grew up watching these front cloth comics in the Salford Hippodrome, which was just outside Manchester. And it was what you would term as a number two or number three theatre. The number denotes the type of venue it was.
Yes.
There were number ones, which were the Moss Empires and the Howard and Wyndhams. Then there was the number twos, little review theatres. And then you would get number threes. But I used to go every Monday night, First House, and sit at the back, ninepence in the pit it was, to sit there and see these wonderful variety shows and watch the old turns. Because my granddad had appeared there, and that's really where my first knowledge of the theatre came into being. And I never thought I'd ever do anything else. I never wanted to do anything else. I didn't know how to get into it at the time.
No.
I just hoped that I'd drift into it like most variety turns.
And in a way, the fact of going on Opportunity Knocks that early in the whole thing, I mean, it was a huge show once it got established, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
I think it established itself very quickly, faster than anybody would have expected, because I remember watching you do that audition on Opportunity Knocks, and thereafter, everybody did your voice. Everybody.
You never know at the time. I mean, you didn't realise at the time. You're standing in a studio, you know, looking into a TV camera. I mean, so you have no conception of the amount of people. 24 million people used to watch Opportunity Knocks.
Extraordinary.
There were only the three channels in 1964, BBC One, Two and ITV, and this was on ITV. Mm. And it was on at 7:30 on a Saturday night.
And the most watched programme of Only Fools and Horses,
yep,
got 24 million.
Yep, yeah, absolutely. And it was 24 million every week. I mean, people just tuned into it.
Yeah.
Even if 10% of those people liked you, you had a great audience.
Yeah.
I was saying to my wife this morning, it's weird, really, because I don't think that while Opportunity Knocks was a great kicking off point, it was all the stuff I did after that, I think, that began to count.
Mm.
I mean, sort of almost immediately, I did A Good Old Days, and then I started to do all the 18 comedy shows, like The Tom Jones Show, Engelbert Humperdinck. I did a load of Des O'Connors. I'd first bumped into Des in Newcastle when I was doing my national service. And he was on a bill with Cyril Stapleton Show Band. And he was at the bottom of the bill, but I thought he was just a great new, young, modern comic. I'm going back to 1957.
Wow.
And I collared him out the stage door and I said, excuse me, Mr. O'Connor, I want to get in the show. But he said, have you got an act? I said, well, not really. Do what I did, he said, and go to Butlins and be a redcoat. I said, oh, thank you. So I wrote off to Butlins as soon as demobbed. And they gave me a job.
Brilliant.
Interviewed me and gave me a job at Skegness. And I never looked back.
I went to Butlins in Skegness with some friends when I was 16. And the main act that performed that week was Des O'Connor.
Was he doing the late night show, was he?
Yeah. And afterwards, he very kindly, I had a photograph taken with him, which I still have.
Tell you a story about Des. Des was always, what I said, very clever because he would surround himself with comics. I mean, he had Jack Douglas was supposed to be his straight man. And I did quite a lot of programs with him in the early days. And I was always very grateful for the fact that he took the trouble to stop and talk to me.
He was a great performer, Des O'Connor, there's no doubt about it. And he very wisely immediately picked up on the thing when Morecambe and Wise took the mickey out of him.
Oh, yeah.
He joined in with that instantly, and it made the nation love him.
That's right. You see, a lot of Eric's comedy, Eric Morecambe, was based on truth. And I don't mean that Des was a bad singer or he was not very good. In actual fact, the opposite, because when Des first started, when he was a young comic, he would do bills with Eric and Ernie and do things with him, you know. And he didn't used to sing in the early days. So Eric's gone, what? He's singing. What? Des?
Yeah.
You know, but it was sort of based on truth. Like, is he really singing? No, he's not. Des is not singing. Surely to God, he can't sing. But, you know, he was a crooner, Des. He got away with it. He was fine.
Yeah, he was good. Fine.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, like them all, Ken Dodd, you know. Tears is one of the best-selling records of all time.
Absolutely. Because it was a lovely sob story for him to finish his act on. He had a nice voice, Ken, you know.
Yeah.
And he was a dear friend, was Ken, bless him. He very kindly did the foreword to my autobiography. But
really?
he was a very, very kind man to other comics, was Ken Dodd. He would always welcome you in the dressing room. And you'd sit down and talk comedy. He loved to talk to comics. He loved to talk comedy. He was just that sort of guy. Not just me, anybody. Mm. I mean, you knew a lot of comics. And he formed a sort of a little club in Liverpool called the Good Turns Society. And it meant good turns, as in people doing good turns for one another, as well as encouraging comedy turns or other types of turns to perform. And it was something that he did five times a year. I went to several of them, actually. It was great fun, great fun.
I did see him shortly before he died at the National Television Awards.
Oh.
And I could not resist walking up and shaking his hand because, you know, he was just this enormous figure in my life.
Probably look at you and say, hello, young man.
He did, absolutely. I went up and he went, hello, young man. Yes, no, come on. No, talk this side because I'm a bit deaf on the other side. And I chatted to him for a couple of minutes. And then he said, anyway, I've got to go. How'd you get a fat girl into bed? Piece of cake. And then he walked off. Oh, no, I'm not sure that's a PC joke anymore, but it's a funny joke. Bless him. Well, I have to say, we are supposed to be talking for my podcast about five things from your life that you'd like to put into a time capsule.
Right.
But I'm perfectly happy just to talk.
No, I've got five things.
That's fantastic.
Actually, if I had two things, I'd be in a circus. Boom, boom. And all those other old jokes. Yes. Well, we can start.
That would be great. Yeah, I'd be very interested to see what you'd pick because you must have so much to choose from.
Yes and no. I mean, I suppose the first thing that ought to go in would be the hat. A lot of people think it's a bowler hat. It's not a bowler hat. In actual fact, it's a Homburg. Now, a Homburg was the sort of hat that Winston Churchill used to wear. Anyway, I bought the first one for using purely as a comedy prop from a second-hand shop in Blackpool for 2 and 6 pence, half a crown in those days. And I recently have seen the same or similar type of hat in a second-hand shop in Ripon, for £98. Consequently, I didn't buy it.
No.
But the posh ones, the really good ones, are made by Locks in London. And they make beautiful hats on the block and they send it to you in a box and it's absolutely gorgeous. The trouble is I ruin them virtually as soon as I put them on. Because when I pull the hat down, my fingers go into the rim of it and it sort of tears it a bit, you know.
Yeah.
So the first hat was half a crown. And I think that hat should be the first in my time capsule.
Yes, I think so. Because for a period of time in the history of this country, there was not a single person who didn't, if they put a hat on, pull it down over their ears and go, I'm thick as a parrot.
You did that very well.
Thank you very much. Well, I've had years of practice, you know. Everybody did it. And that's quite a thing to have in your life, isn't it? I mean, you said earlier, just like that, and we all know who that is.
Yes.
There are very few people. How tickled I am. These sort of phrases that comedians had that defined them, that said, this is who I am.
I mean, you don't know at the time that it's going to be like that. No. Course. I mean, I didn't realise that it would catch on. For me, it was just a gag in my act.
Yeah.
Then, of course, I realised after that it was something easy that people could impersonate.
Well, of course, impressionists are always looking for that thing they can hang the impression on. So having that sort of catchphrase, the audience knows who they're doing immediately.
Yes.
So did all those years at the holiday camp, did you develop an act during that time? Because you have to do everything at a holiday camp.
Yes. When I first went to Skegness in 1958, Frank Mansell, who employed me, he was the entertainment manager, and he really became a bit of a mentor to me. He put me calling the bingo, which was called Tombola.
Mm.
And I was the caller. But it got me into talking to an audience, of course. And in between the games, I would tell gags. And I used to, most of their annoyance, I would tell gags, you know, during the games, which I didn't like. And I developed this thing about always doing the wrong numbers. You know, the usual things like clickety-click 66, I'd go clickety-click 28. And they'd go, what? So I used to get some stick for that. Anyway, I did that for 2 seasons because my big mate on the camp, of course, was Dave Allen.
How long were you both at the campsite together?
6 years.
6 years. And was Dave Allen there right the way through that?
He was there most of it, yes. He was there for the first 3 years at least. Mm. His act in those days was totally different than we remember him. He used to do a sort of crazy sort of Jerry Lewis type act. Very funny. He had sort of long hair, like a pageboy style hair, in fact. And, we were great mates. We remained friends for the rest of his life because he went to Australia and then he became a talk show host in Australia.
Yeah.
And he was actually quite a big star over there. And he came back over here and Richard Stone, his agent, he went out and did tours with the Beatles and eventually became one of Britain's best comics, really.
Oh, absolutely. One of the great comics.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's extraordinary to think of that manic running around the stage comedy. And suddenly to drop down to that incredibly laid-back style that he had.
It's all part of the learning experience and finding yourself and finding what you can do and what you can't do, you know.
All right, lovely. So we should put your Eden hat squashed down over your ears into the time capsule as your first item. What's your second item?
My second item would be, it's a bit of a pride and joy for me, and that would be a gold record I received for a song. It was written by Bill Owen, you know, the actor.
Yeah, Last of the Summer Wine.
That's right. He was quite a prolific songwriter.
Oh.
Yes, he wrote quite a lot of songs. He put the English lyrics to this Italian ballad called Sempre Sempre, which became So Lucky.
Mm-hmm.
Now, So Lucky, it's always been a lovely ballad. So lucky in my life, you love me as I am. That's all just as a man. I ask no more than this. And it's about a man talking about the woman in his life.
Mm.
It's a lovely song. And I had a recording manager who'd found this song and said, why don't you ever go out singing? It's a straight song, with Doddy in mind, of course, and singing a straight song.
Mm.
So I managed to do the record. You know, I don't have a great voice, but I got away with it. And Pi Records loved it. They put it out and it got all the plays, but it didn't sell. And about 6 months later, we started to get royalties from the Philippines. You're not supposed to laugh. Michael, you're not.
All right, I'm not laughing, no. No, really, the Philippines, how lovely.
You're entitled to laugh. And we thought, that's strange, the Philippines. Why has it become a hit in the Philippines? And it had. So we found out it had been the first track of a compilation album of ballads. but it became a hit in the Philippines. The next time we got a royalty check from Brazil.
Brazil?
Of all places.
That's a huge population.
So much so that I got a gold record from Brazil.
Wow.
Presented by the Brazilian ambassador at the embassy in London, and everybody spoke Portuguese, apart from myself and the executives from Pi Records. We stood there, and the record is in Portuguese, and the gold record is in Portuguese. I can't understand what it says, and it's lovely. It's my pride and joy, and I'd love to put that in.
Yeah. Oh, what a wonderful thing to have.
Yes, it's marvellous, and it's got a life. It's still got a life. And you mustn't laugh again.
No.
It gets lots of plays at funerals and weddings because it's a love story.
I think that's quite an honour, I think, to have your song chosen as the song that they want to hear as the coffin's coming in or being taken out. That's beautiful.
Yes. A lovely lady wrote to me and she said, we'd like to use it for the first dance at our wedding. And she said, would you mind if we used it? And I said, not at all. I'd be absolutely delighted. She said, my husband is a fan of yours. And is there any way you could do a sort of a dedication to it and send it to us? I said, of course I will. So I did a little sound recording. And it so happened that I was doing a book signing. The wedding was in Southport. I was doing a book signing in Blackpool. And I said, how far is it from Blackpool to Southport? And somebody said, oh, it's not far. So I went.
Oh, brilliant.
The only person I told was the DJ. I called the DJ and I said, look, if I turn up, can you play a backing track for me if I bring it for so long? He said, of course I will.
Oh.
So I went over and sang it to her, sang it to them.
Oh, how fantastic.
And he put the backing track on and I started to sing it out of the room. And it just sounded like it was a record, right?
Mm.
And then I came in with the mic and they were just, and then they couldn't dance. They were just in tears, bless them. It was...
You would never forget a thing like that. That is an amazing thing to do.
No, and they were just so thrilled, I can't tell you. I was doing a gig in about 6 or 7 weeks later, doing a gig down in the South Coast somewhere, and they turned up with flowers and champagne for me and everything. And they said, oh, you took the trouble to come to us, so we took the trouble to come and see you. And it was just lovely.
What a lovely, lovely story.
It is a sweet story, isn't it? Yes.
Yeah. But I have to say, I was always very fond of those songs that comics sang at the end. Don't Laugh at Me, I'm a Fool, and Tears for Souvenirs. Yeah. And
I mean, he wrote that, of course. Norman Wisdom wrote that song.
Oh, did he?
I have a lovely story about Norman.
He was at school with my mother.
Oh, bless him. I knew Norman quite well as most. When I went into production in the 80s, I heard on the grapevine that they were looking for a pantomime for the new theatre, Oxford, but they'd been let down by their production company. And it so happened that I was about to produce a panto with Norman Wisdom in another venue. But Oxford was obviously going to be more attractive to him because it was a bigger venue. But then I had to persuade him to do it. So I went to the Isle of Man, where he lived, and he met me at the airport in his roller, went back to the house. And before I got chatting, he thought I'd come to see him about the thing that I booked him for, the theatre, and he kept talking about it, and I couldn't interrupt him. And he said, now, I'm going to show you what the panto is like I'm going to do. And he sat at the piano, and he performed the entire pantomime while I sat in an armchair in his lounge. And he was a very good pianist, and I sat there for about 3 hours, and I said, but Norman, I don't want you to do this venue. So he said, what? I said, no, I want you to do Oxford instead. He said, I don't want to do Oxford.
Oh, no.
I eventually talked to him. It was very successful.
Mm.
But I'll never forget sitting in his lounge, watching him play this grand piano beautifully and doing the entire show.
Amazing.
He was a gentleman and a great performer and a very funny man, you know, and he was a part of my history.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, you both share that extraordinary thing of later in life, having been a stand-up and doing comedy all your life, suddenly being asked to do rather serious acting in serious productions.
Yeah. You know, Michael, most of the things I've done in my life, I've sort of drifted into. I mean, I never intended to do any. I never intended to go into management. And that was purely going in to help a friend of mine whose husband had died. And I said I'd go in and help her in the office. He was a producer. And I said, I'll come in a couple of days and help you. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. I loved the creative side. And I sort of started to produce and direct a few pantos and bits and bobs. And it was, you know, it was interesting. It was something different from me. I still did my stand-up. I still went out and did one-nighters and gigs, and it allowed me to do that, you know, a few hours each day. I found it fun. And then I went out on my own for a few years. I think a director should try and get the best out of people. I always felt that you look at a performer and you think, how can I make this work better? Having done it myself, I always took notice of other directors who I'd worked with and picked the brains of the best. You know, but if I didn't know how to do something, I'd ask.
Yeah, quite. Great fun. There we are. All right. So Lucky, your lovely song goes into the time capsule. That's number two.
Yeah.
So number three we're up to. Right. Sorry to interrupt this podcast, but I have a small announcement to make. Will the owner of a blue Ford C-Max registration number GF58MUK, that's GF58MUK, have a happy life? Well, we hope so. Anyway, here are some ads. Back in a moment.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Welcome back. Let's rush right back to Freddie Parrotface Davis and see what else he'd like to keep safe in his time capsule.
Number three. I think maybe the tape of Opportunity Knocks, that first op knocks, which meant so much to me. At the time, and has meant so much since, because it's still referred to from people of a certain age who do either remember it or remember that I used to go on. I didn't win it, you see. I wasn't a winner. I was beaten by a little song and dance man called Bobby Bennett. He'd won the week before. I suppose I was second.
But that's in the history of those sort of contests. That's a very common thing, isn't it? That is, the person who doesn't win goes on to be the more famous.
Yeah. And then what happened? It took on a strange path because Bobby was beaten by the musical muscle man.
Oh, yeah.
He was the bodybuilder who stood there, you know, with a dink, tink, 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 tink.
Yeah.
And he won for 8 weeks. So by the end of the first series, there was only three people they could use in the final.
Oh, of course.
The musical muscle man, Bobby Bennett, and the woman who won the first 2 weeks, she was a soprano. So they had to bring back other contestants.
Yeah.
And that's where I came in.
Yeah, and how was Huey Green?
Oh, it was very encouraging. I mean, he was so proud of the people that came through the programme and did well. It was quite a stable in the end. Mary Hopkin,
yeah.
Peters and Lee, and Frank Carson, and Lena Zavaroni. All those people came up via Op Knocks.
Yeah. Of course, what people forget is, as you say, there were so few television channels. Now you can watch television anytime you like, whenever you choose to watch it.
Yes.
But then, if you wanted to watch Opportunity Knocks, you all gathered around the telly at the same time.
Yeah, well, that's why these people became so popular, of course.
Of course.
You know, it became huge. Sunday Night at the Palladium. I did Sunday Night at the Palladium in November 1965.
Was that with Bruce?
No, it was with Jimmy.
Ah, right.
Jimmy's first Palladium was 63.
Mm-hmm.
I'd just left Butlins, and it was my first club date from leaving Butlins. And it was a club called the 99 Club Barrow. And on the Saturday night, the guy doing the emceeing said to me, "She was on the Palladium tomorrow night." I said, "No." He said, "Jimmy Tarbuck." I said, "What? Jimmy Tarbuck from Liverpool?" He said, "Yes." I said, "I don't believe it." So he said, "Why?" I said, "Well, the last time I saw him, he was working at Butlins in Brighton. He took over my bed about 3 years ago. And he told me he didn't have an act." And anyway, he didn't last very long. Apparently, he got the sack because they said he didn't speak English. So I was very interested to see what he did on the Palladium.
Well, he was, as far as comedy is concerned, he was the Beatles, wasn't he? Because he was young, yeah. He was quite good looking, and he was from Liverpool.
He was of the day.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was literally thrown at the deep end, but he did exceptionally well. So when I did it, he was still the MC. Because we were mates. I remember standing in the wings waiting to go on. I said, "How did you cope with the nerves, Jim?" He said, "I get the same every week." He said, "That's why I fluff it, you know." Because when you only got one chance, that's the awful thing that when you're going on. The nerves are their normal nerves, and then they doubled and trebled on top of that.
Mm.
And as soon as you walk on, the mouth goes dry.
Oh, don't.
You kill for a bucket of water.
Yeah. When I do a play, I try to build into the first scene a moment where I have a drink. And it's all because I know that on the first night, I'm going to desperately want one because of the nerves.
That's what happens as soon as you walk on.
It's extraordinary how quickly that goes, though, isn't it? Once you're through it.
Yes, it does go. Yeah. Once you get over those first few lines.
Mm.
I mean, I was so nervous when I first started. I couldn't talk. I used to have to do a trick. So I taught myself some sleight of hand magic. And did a thing with a thimble and a cigarette and a little billiard ball just to get me over that first moment. So I always say I started out doing magic. So when I talk to a magic club, I say, "Oh, I was a magician when I started."
I mean, when you think about it, that whole thing of you're saying about Dave Allen being coming on and doing this sort of manic character, that again would be an attempt to get through the nerves, I should imagine. That's probably why that character was devised in the first place.
Yeah, probably. I mean, if you're working the same venue every night, it will help because you're used to playing that same venue, walking onto that same stage, mm-hmm. walking up to that same microphone and seeing the audience there. You know, that can get you over a lot because at least you've done it before.
Yes.
So I always say the problem with young acts these days is they have nowhere to learn how to be bad. Right? You've got to be bad before you can be any good.
Yes.
Because it's only from being bad that you learn what not to do,
mm-hmm.
not necessarily what to do, what not to do. That's part of the apprenticeship, working all these places, terrible one night, good the next night. What did you do wrong? Why did it go right? Why did it go wrong? And that's all part of the learning process. So I always say, what you've got to do is to try and cover yourself for that, the inevitability of it not working.
Mm.
So try and do as much as you can before you actually go on that night. Make sure you're there early, get used to the venue, have a sound check, make sure the lighting's right. All a comic wants is to be seen and heard.
Mm.
Try and get on a raised platform so that they can see more of you.
Yeah.
And I always tell people to stand still because if you're running about all over the stage, you're causing your own distraction. So all the pros who are listening now, and I hope there are a few, believe me, honestly, if you stand still, it goes better.
Well, you can say that, but you have famously worked with Lee Evans, who never stands still once.
No, no. Let me qualify what I said.
Mm-hmm.
I said, if you do not, well, I'll start again. If you have to run about as part of your act and have to move, and it's effective that when you move, it works, then by all means, ignore me. But if you're just standing telling jokes, you don't need to walk about.
No, very good advice. Okay, right, so opportunity knocks, and it did knock for you, and it's going into the time capsule, which is lovely.
Please.
Okay, so we've done your gold disc, the hat, and opportunity knocks.
Yeah.
Okay, right, so number four.
Okay. Many years ago, the first panto I ever directed was in 1974, and I had a young lad who became the ASM, and the panto was Cinderella, and it was in Ipswich, the Gaumont Cinema, Ipswich.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't easy to put on, but we sort of got away with it. I tell a lovely story Alan Rickman told me. I'd never met him before. And I met him at a premiere of one of the Harry Potters. I did a spit in a coffin, one of the Harry Potters. Yeah. And he said, "Oh, Mr. Davis, I've been wanting to meet you." He said, "Do you know how I started?" I said, "No." He said, "I started at the Rex Wimslow playing King Rat." He said, "And I've been playing the same part ever since." So in all those throws, I'm going to start this again.
Okay.
Because I'm fucking it up.
Come at it again.
Ask me the question.
Okay, so what's your fourth thing to go into the time capsule?
It's a film called Funny Bones.
Ah.
And it came about, we're talking about Lee Evans, many, many years before, when the director's mother asked me, could I help her son, who was showbiz crazy, wanted to get into the business. He was 17 and he was still at school in Blackpool. And I said, well, let's see what you can do. And I gave him the job as ASN at the first pantomime I'd ever directed, which was in Ipswich at the Gaumont. And he came down and did everything I asked him to do. You know, he cleaned up after the ponies in Cinderella. He took the ponies on the stage and guided them on. He was the major domo in the ballroom, Cinderella, you know, saying, "My lords, ladies and gentlemen, the ugly sisters." And he was great. But he used to sit backstage and listen to all the old pros telling all the old stories, just like I'm doing now. And after that pantomime, he went for proper drama training. And he became a very, very good actor. Finished up at the National, but that's not what he wanted to do. He wanted to direct films. So Peter Chelson became a film director. And the first film he directed was a little 11-minute short for Channel 4 called Treacle. And it was about my first experience as a young lad being told to tell jokes. I was stood on a chair in a pub and I had to do an act. And I did my granddad's act. And he remembered these stories from backstage there, and he wanted to do stories that he knew about. Mm. The second film he made was a thing called Hear My Song, which was the Joseph Locke story, which really was about Blackpool. And we were always in conversation. We talked night and day, and he was doing very well as an actor, very well indeed, but he wanted to direct. So I talked about my granddad's act, which was an old-fashioned paper slap routine. And he took this on board and lots of other stories, and he loved comedy. And so he wrote this treatment for a film called Funny Bones. He brought in a very good writer called Peter Flannery, and they did a great script. And with the success of Hear My Song, he got money from Disney to make Funny Bones. And as I said, once again, the rest is history. It was a great film. I don't know, have you seen it?
Oh, I have, yeah, a number of times. It is a great film.
Yes, it's a great showbiz film, and he did it very, very well.
It has real heart as well. That's the thing I love about it.
It finished up, not the film it started, because he overshot everything, and we were 45 minutes yet to take out. So it became a sort of a slightly different story in the end. But the original story was good, and the story finished with it, and I thought it was a very exciting finish. And I say it was a Hollywood film. Hollywood money, made in Blackpool. It was just, and it was marvellous, wonderful to do.
And it had those wonderful moments where people actually did those acts, did their old acts and things. And it was just great,
it was great
watching
George Carl was marvellous. I mean, I danced with Leslie Caron. I mean, what about that for a memory? I mean, she was playing my ex-wife in it.
Yeah.
Oh, just amazing, absolutely amazing. And Jerry Lewis was a joy.
Right.
He was lovely. But it was just wonderful to watch these people on the screen, watch them, how they approached what they were doing and how they prepared. You know, these wonderful film stars, Oliver Reed. Oliver was a great actor, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Just wonderful actor, wonderful to watch. And of course, Lee Evans' first film, he was tremendous in it. Absolutely tremendous. I mean, what amazing star he's become.
Absolutely. I love the fact that he doesn't... It's not the be-all and end-all for Lee. He's had a fantastic time, incredible success, and yet he's now sort of sat back and gone, well, actually, I'm going to spend some time with my family.
I admire him. I'm a tremendous admirer of Lee. I love him to bits.
Yes. Yes, I've worked with him, and he's just one of the nicest men you could ever meet.
Oh, he's absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah.
So I think I'd like that to go into the time machine. Because that, I mean, yes, for me also, because you know, one of the biggest joys of my life. I mean, I've had actors come up to me in the street in Soho and say, "You can die with pleasure now, Freddie. You've done that film."
Yeah. There's a theme coming through your choices and, in fact, your behaviour during your career, which is that being nice to people just because they're famous or successful is not you. Being nice to people just because you are nice to people really pays off. I mean, doing that thing for those people at that wedding, it's a beautiful thing to do. Taking the care. Somebody says, I've got my 17-year-old boy quite fancies going into the business. Can you help him out? And you then take him on. Now, all right, he paid you back by working hard and doing what you told him, but there's no need to do something like that. And in the end, that leads you to being cast in his incredibly successful film years later. You deserved it.
No, it's very kind of you to say that, but I didn't. I told you because I wanted to tell you about So Lucky, and also that Peter went on to do great things. I'm proud of the fact that he started with me. I'm thrilled. You know, we've been in contact recently, actually, Peter and I, and I told him how proud I am of him.
Yeah.
You know, how thrilled I am that he's done so well. I am thrilled about it.
No, I absolutely don't. Don't say it in as much as there's you boasting about these things. These are things that have come out of this conversation by chance, but to me, they really sum you up, I think.
That's very kind of you. Thank you, sir.
No.
You know, when I wrote my book, I've called it Funny Bones, actually, and I had to remember these certain things. I think that's where it all came back to me, the fact that I had to recall it. I actually put the book out 50 years to the day from Up Knox.
Really?
So I'm about to update the book.
And when will that be out?
Probably just after Christmas, I think.
Lovely.
Because I'm just about to run out of the initial print, would you believe? I mean, they printed 12 and then another 12. So I'm just...
And you sold one to every relative?
Every relative. And they expected me to give them as well.
Well, we will put the film Funny Bones, and we'll put a copy of your autobiography in there as well, I think. We'll update it when the time comes. That goes into the time capsule. That's really
put
lovely.
Put it in on top.
Yeah, put it on top. Okay, so we've got one item left.
Is this the one to bury or...?
One that we want to get rid of, yeah.
Okay. Just after I did Up Knox, because I was still out of work, although the phone did start to ring, and I think probably one of the first calls was from a booker called Hal Monty, and he was booking near bases, American army bases around Paris, around France. And he saw me do Up Knox, and he thought good physical act be great for the American army. Not. So he booked me for 2 weeks. So I arrive on the Monday, and they take me to the hotel, and there's about three or four American acts there. And we have to work that night, and it's a four-hour drive out of Paris. So the guy that's playing for the show, a pianist, drives the car. I'm sat on his right, obviously, and he has two acts in the back. So there's three people, but there are another two acts in the back. So we get to the venue, we do the show. I die the biggest death you've ever seen. Like, dreadful. He gets drunk, the pianist, driver, and we're going to get back in the car, got to drive back to Paris, and it's midnight. So who can drive? These two acts in the back of the car said, I don't drive. I can't drive in France. I've never driven over here. So I get in the driver's seat, left-hand side, never driven in France before, wrong side of the road. Overnight, I'm driving back, and they're screaming from the back of the car, keep to the left, keep to the right, swing over to the... We arrive back 5 a.m. in these beautiful flower markets, and this guy wakes up, the pianist wakes up sitting next to me, and he said, okay, I see where you are. Make a left, make a right, drop me off. They never used me again. I had to stay in a hotel for 2 weeks.
Oh, no.
Never asked me to perform again. Were the worst 2 weeks I think I've ever spent, because the other acts were doing the shows, and they kept saying to me, oh, they don't want a comic. They don't want a comic at this place.
Right.
They don't need a comic.
Oh, no.
But they paid me, and it was 2 weeks in August in Paris. The place was deserted. It was a holiday, and it was screaming hot. And I just lived about for 2 weeks, walked around Paris, stayed in a hotel until I came back.
Well, some people would say that was lovely, but that's, again, your sort of your sensibility, which is that you were hired to do a job and you weren't doing it, and that ruined it for you.
I was pleased in a way they didn't use me again, because you perform in their what they call their NAFI, And they were just sat reading newspapers when I went on.
Oh, Lord.
Oh, it was terrible. And I just had this so-called success in Britain.
Yeah.
And the next job I do, I'd die.
You think the whole of Britain's got it wrong.
So I want to bury that
yes.
as far down as you can get it.
Well, I'll get it there almost so that if anybody mentions it again to you, you'll go, I don't know what you're talking about. I can't remember that. I don't think I've ever been to Paris. I've never been anywhere near Paris.
Has anybody told you, Michael, that you look like a young Roy Hudd?
Oh, I'm very delighted at that. I love Roy Hudd.
Yeah, no, you do. You have a look of a young Roy Hudd about you.
Oh, bless you. What a great performer Roy Hudd was. His delivery of a gag was always great.
Oh, he's a good comic, Roy.
Yeah.
Great comic. We did a Cilla Black TV show together.
Right.
And it was the last of the series. I think it was her first TV series. I know her opening song was Step Inside Love. And, no, I remember it well. And at the end of the first series, she had a party in a very posh club in London somewhere. And that was where I sat next to, on my right-hand side was Frankie Howard, and on the other side was Paul McCartney with Jane Asher.
Oh, my word.
So it just shows how long ago it was. Yeah, and he told me a lovely story. He said, when I rehearse yesterday, he said, I do it like you. So he goes, yesterday.
No, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, wonderful.
I'm never going to be able to listen to that song again without thinking of that.
It's just a weird thought, isn't it?
Yeah.
A weird picture.
Well, you sort of ruined it for me, but not really, actually.
It's still a beautiful song.
It's a beautiful song. It really is. Yeah. Well, I have to say, hang on a minute. I have to say, it's been an absolute joy talking to you.
An absolute, can do it right for God's
sake. I'm not as good at it as you are.
You're gonna, no, you've got to do it once for me. I'm just about thick up there. Come on, you can do
all
it.
All right. I'm thick up to here.
That's not bad.
Thank you.
That's only I'll make you do it.
Oh, Freddie, thank you so much. Lovely to talk to you. Lovely to meet you and brilliant it's been to have you on My Time Capsule.
Bless you.
You have been listening to My Time Capsule with me, Mike Fenton-Stevens, and my guest, Freddie Davis, who I have to say looks nothing like a parrot. Please subscribe to this podcast if you haven't already, and do rate the show before you leave us. You may even find the time to write a small review for Apple Podcasts or your own podcast provider. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can listen to the theme tune on Spotify. It was written by Pass the Peas Music. Our producer was John Fenton Stevens, and this has been a cast-off production for Acast. Thank you for listening. I'll leave you with a little joke that Freddie gave me to add to my joke book. Right. If you want to give a loaf of bread the best possible chance of winning Wimbledon, first, make sure it's seeded. Yep, that may be the one and only time that joke will be told. Well, in public, anyway. Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itzinas.
I'm Kayla Itzinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.